Welcome to the Shattering Myths program, where we expose the misconceptions associated with religion and politics, military and economic schemes. For those of you who know that I've had a long history of doing a program on KGAB with Dave Chaffin in the morning, that's where I spent the last hour. For those who would like to make a regular experience of listening to the KGAB exchange, which is really a precursor to this show in a lot of ways, I've been an hour-long guest on Dave's show now on a regular basis for 11 years, where we have discussed very many of the issues, in fact, all the issues that were discussed last night in the international relations debate, where I was able to tell America precisely what the consequence was going to be of our malfeasance in the Middle East. And so that'll be a regular event every Tuesday of the month at this at the hour prior to this show, particularly the third Tuesday of the month. Well, instead of merely presenting the news, those who've listened to this program know that we try to explain why these things are happening and what they portend for our future, in fact, our immediate future. Then during the second hour, we turn our attention to God. To his terms, to his covenant, and to his Torah teaching. We strive to replace religion with reason. Our phone number for those who would like to participate in this discussion is 877-300-7645. And for those looking for verification for the perspective presented on this show, I would encourage you to go to introtogod.org. Last night, the President of the United States decided he would take a page from the Biden playbook and recognize that with the preponderance of American people, you are swayed as to who wins the debate by who is the nastiest, who is the most childish, who is the most immature. And he made a practice of demeaning his opponent, of creating a straw man relative to his opponent, to overtly lying to the American people, and just all around being obnoxious. And two-thirds of those who were undecided gave him the thumbs up for that performance. But I'd like to hold his feet to the fire, if I might. He said that he personally, me, I am the one who was the first in the world to embrace what happened in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Libya, and therefore ushered in this new world order. But what happened in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Libya, is that in each of those three countries, secular governments were replaced by fundamentalist Islamic ones. This was an Islamic reformation. Not the Arab Spring. The victor here is the death and chaos that follows Islam. Rather than bringing peace, there will be war. Rather than bringing prosperity, there will be great poverty. This is what this president ushered in. It was his grand scheme of things when he became president and even before the election. He went over to the Islamic world and gave great speeches as to how Islam had changed the landscape of the world and was this wonderful religion. And fundamentalist Muslims rose up and they created this tapestry of death. Then he concluded his comments on his great international triumphs by saying that this administration, he himself, is making sure that all of these countries are more supportive of women, when in fact the opposite is true. Because they become more fundamentalist Islamic, women's rights will continue to fade into oblivion, just as they are in Saudi Arabia, where a woman can't do anything. She has no rights. You look at Afghanistan, the country that we currently have the most control. Before we went in, there were infrequent, although harsh, retributions perpetrated against women by the Taliban. But they are infinitely worse today. Far more women are abused in Afghanistan, under American control, than under the Taliban. We did exactly the opposite. Freedom is less prevalent in these countries than it was before the onslaught of Islamic fundamentalism, as is democracy. You see, Islam is about submission. It is about the avoidance of choice. That is what Allah says in his Quran. There is no freedom. There is no choice for the Muslim. They must follow orders. They must submit, which is what Islam means in Arabic. Economic prosperity took a nosedive as a result, even though this president says, oh, we're going to make sure there is great economic prosperity. The reason there is no economic prosperity in Islamic countries is because their moral code won't allow it. There is no rule of law. And therefore, there is no reason to invest one's time and energy knowing that it will just be confiscated or whatever they create destroyed. It's why there is no product made in an Islamic country that sells on international markets. It's why they have invented nothing in this last several hundred years that has made the world any better. It is why, if you want to see what hell is like, you can go visit any one of the 50 Islamic countries. Rather than peace, what this president wrought on the world is a new Islamic jihad. And that is why the cry in all of these countries is now death to Israel, death to the United States. What happened in Libya, in Benghazi, with our ambassador was not a fluke. It was the consequence of what this president has wrought. But he is not alone to blame. Romney is now speaking of Iran as America's primary enemy. But why? Why is Iran now America's primary enemy? The reason is because America invaded Iraq. We removed a secular dictator, made that country fundamentalist Islamic, and we gave Iran's only enemy to Iran, so that now they control Iran. And as a result, rather than being thwarted from developing their nuclear ambitions, they are free to do so and are doing so. Iran is a threat to America as a direct result of America invading Iraq, which is why 10 years ago I begged America not to do it. The war that Romney wants to send weapons to the Mujahideen and the jihadists to assault tanks and fighter jets and helicopters. That war is a proxy war that's a direct result of us invading Iraq. We created the civil war that is being fought in Syria. It is our fault. You see, Syria was a proxy of Iraq through the Ba'athist Party unity of Saddam Hussein and Assad. And yet, when we invaded Iraq and deposed the secular government and gave that country to Iran, Syria is now a client of Iran. Saudi Arabia doesn't like that because the Saudis are the fundamentalist Sunni movement and power and influence in the Middle East. And their arch enemy are the Shias in Iran. And so Saudi Arabia decided, why don't we supply American weapons to the fundamentalist Muslims in Syria? They can wage a civil war against the Shiite government. And it's a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia as a direct result of the United States invasion of Iraq. We have brought the world to a dangerous place because of our malfeasance in foreign policy. The contender, Mitt Romney, spoke of the problem being Islamic extremism. But that's not the case. The problem is not Islamic extremism. The problem is Islamic fundamentalism. The president just went on to say the problem is just extremism, dropping the Islamic label. We have zero chance, Americans. We have zero chance, those who are listening to this program in New Zealand and the UK and Denmark and in Australia, we have no chance whatsoever of prevailing against fundamentalist Islam in their assault on the world if we continue to disguise the enemy, if we continue to pretend that the enemy is terrorism, which is a tactic, or we pretend the enemy is Al-Qaeda, which has always been irrelevant. The contender said that We had fewer ships now than we had in the early 1900s. I think it was 1916, to which the president responded, yes, but we have fewer horses and bayonets as well. And then spoke of, have you ever heard of, we have these ships that carry airplanes. We call them aircraft carriers. And in a demeaning fashion, we have these ships that go underwater. We call them submarines. Yes, Scott.
It was 1917, and I was actually just reading about this, so the fact that you came to this right as I was reading it. The Navy is actually, it's at 282 ships right now, which mm-hmm. is the exact same number that was in George Bush's final year in office.
Yep.
So he hasn't done anything to increase it at all, but he also hasn't done anything to decrease it, so... 2007 was when it was at its lowest.
Yep. Guess what, folks? The reality is that our Navy is not making America safer. Our aircraft carriers are stunningly vulnerable. Most leading countries around the world could destroy all of our aircraft carriers very effectively and very quickly. I could go in and tell you how that was done. I discussed it with Navy officers, and they all acknowledge it. Our aircraft carriers are nothing but a liability. If we have a foe, they're destroyed in a matter of moments with very little cost. And our submarines have no purpose. They bob around under the water as a deterrent with nuclear weapons. If they were to fire their weapons, the world as we know it ceases to exist. That's not an option, folks. It isn't making us safer. The very fact that we can project a force causes us to project a force and makes America more vulnerable. Because we can project a force, we invaded Iraq and Afghanistan, and in both cases we were suicidal in our foreign policy. We pushed the fundamentalist Muslims out of Afghanistan into Pakistan, which is a country with nuclear weapons, and they will be deployed in the United States as a result. We gave Iraq to Iran so it could complete its nuclear program. What we did was counterproductive because we could. America's Navy isn't making America safer. It's making America more vulnerable.
Well, usually when you have a weapon, the big fear is that a weapon gets turned on you. Like, if you have a knife for protection and stuff like that, mm-hmm. they always tell you you're more likely to get stabbed with your own knife, you know?
You know, the reality is our military is not used to defend America. If our military was here to defend America, they'd be deployed in America, along America's borders. They would not be deployed around the world as an invasion force. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. More on these myths after the break.
What's going on?
Hello, and welcome back to Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yetta. I'd like to focus on the principal thrust of last night's debate. The President of the United States, by his own admission and by his own statements, sought to present Mitt Romney as inexperienced and therefore disqualify him from being seen as an international strategist or as commander-in-chief of the United States. And during the debate, he says, listen, Mr. Romney, you know, it's obvious that you've had no experience acting in international circles. So, you know, you don't have anything to stand on. And everything you've said, your opinions, when you have given them, and that's all you have all been wrong. And if you're Mitt Romney, you've got to have known that that was going to be the primary thrust of this debate by the Obama administration, that they were going to present Romney as inexperienced and his opinions as being wrong. And yet Romney couldn't respond, didn't respond. And it was such an easy That was like in T-ball, having the ball put on a stand for you and say, hey, kid, swing away. Teed up right for him. All he had to say is, and all due respect, Mr. President, 4 years ago, the exact same thing was said of you. And it proved to be true. Look how big a mess the world is in. The European Union is crumbling. The Islamic world is becoming ever more fundamentalist and is deteriorating before our very eyes. Our relationships with China are falling apart. The world on an international stage is far worse. In Russia, you now have a fascist government. Everything that you've touched has gotten worse because you had no experience. And let's bring that home. You, not one day in your life, ever earned a penny actually working in the free enterprise system. And as a result of having no experience in business, you've destroyed American business and mismanaged this economy. Indeed, experience matters. And because you had none, our economy is in ruins and the world is falling apart. Why couldn't he say that? But he didn't. He just rolled over. And all he could say is, attacking me is not a strategy. He couldn't even say that you're using a straw man argument and that that is not a tactic. He couldn't even say that by interrupting and being so rude, you're showing that you're not qualified, that you don't have the demeanor, you don't have the decorum to be president of the United States. This is not what Americans deserve. But he couldn't even say that. Yes, Scott.
Do you think that was a part of his plan originally? Because after the, like I said, after the, like I talked to you in the break, after the vice presidential debate, it became obvious that they came up with a different strategy of the attack strategy.
Right. Let's interrupt. Let's be rude. Let's be condescending. Let's create a straw man because that will appeal to America. And guess what? It worked. Well, Americans are motivated by that kind of slimy scheme.
I understand, and but do you think that he wanted to show that he was trying to, you know, by not falling into his trap, you know, falling into his game? Do you think he was trying to separate himself that way? Because personally,
you have the opportunity to completely disqualify the existing president, the incumbent president of the United States. He tees it up for you.
Yep.
On an experience level, and you don't even respond, and so your lack of response is designed to show, well, yeah, you know, in the vice presidential debate, this was the tactic, and we didn't respond to the tactic, and they won the debate, so I'm going to deploy that same strategy. I'm going to let them attack and be obnoxious, and I'm not going to respond either. I'm just going to lay down.
Yep. I understand what you're saying, and I agree with what you're saying, but do you think that they were telling him, you know, the people that, because there are people in the Republican Party around him,
yes,
that are
yes,
relaying to him different strategies.
Yes,
and,
yes,
you know,
I think they,
maybe
yes,
they were saying, you know, look, don't
rock the boat here.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't rock the boat here. Just come out of this unscathed and let him attack you all he wants. Your response every time he attacks you is saying, attacking me is not a strategy. And walk out of here without making a fool of yourself, recognizing that the incumbent president, because he is privy to everything, has it all over the contender when it comes to international relations. I mean, the debate in this case is so stacked in favor of the president that the only way that you could prevail as the contender is if the president of the United States does something as stupid as this president did by teeing up the ball and saying, experience is what you lack. And it would have been so easy for Romney to have won the debate and the election on that one option. So if that was the strategy of the Republicans, shame on them. To Shattering Myths, I'm your host, Yada. Scott has told me personally that he'll pay for your call should you wish to engage in this conversation. It's 877-300-7645. I want to turn our attention back to what we discussed in the first half of yesterday's program. We received a number of emails of people who seem to have been confused as to what I said and the point that was being made. So I'm going to go over the material again. I'm going to try to explain it more effectively and discuss not only its consequence, but how what has happened in America is... has caused us to further distance ourselves from Yahweh and His covenant. All right. As you know, the contender, Mitt Romney, was stereotypically recorded. It happened to be by Hodding Carter, a nephew of Jimmy Cotta, the great anti-Semite who is responsible for equipping and aiding both Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And he was talking about campaign strategy, and he says that there is no reason for him to focus on a certain group of people. He said these are the people who pay no income tax. 47% of Americans pay no income tax. So our message of low taxes does not connect with them. My job as a campaigner is to not worry about those people who believe that they are victims, who believe that the government has a responsibility to care for them. I'll never convince them that they should take personal responsibility and care for their lives. Of course, now the Obama administration having inappropriately, stereotypically recorded this message by Hodding Carta, Jimmy Carter's nephew, and then releasing it, has taken, just like Satan did in the Garden of Eden, has taken what Governor Romney said out of context, then misquoted him, and then twisted the result to create a conclusion that is entirely beguiling. It is exactly how Satan took what God had said out of context, misquoted him, and twisted the result to mislead Chawa and cause both Adam and Chawa to be expelled from the Garden of Eden. So let's examine this. What I shared with you yesterday is that not only was the number right, that approximately 50% of Americans don't pay any income tax, the number... in 2009, the last year we have really good visibility of the number provided by the U.S. government itself, was that in 2009, 51% paid no income tax. The estimate now is that that 47% are paying no tax. These are those who file tax returns and pay no tax. Is 47-48%, but the last number where it is known for absolute certain was 51%. That was in 2009. The trend there is even more alarming, though, than the number. And the trend is that in 1969, just 40 years earlier, 12% of those who filed taxes, tax returns, paid no tax. Not even a penny. 12% in 1969, that increased fourfold to 51% by 2009. That's an alarming statistic. That means that people are voting in the democratic process for candidates that are increasing the number who have no contribution to the society, who are net beneficiaries and not contributors to the society. Now, let's move on to the indulgence side, to the, that's the failure to give, the failure to contribute. Let's look at the side of the equation of those who think that the government owes them something, that they're entitled. Today, the federal government runs 80 different welfare programs of one kind or another. And almost all of these programs, just like the rates that we have seen in those who do not pay any tax, has escalated rapidly. This is a freight train that is out of control and lurching off a cliff. According to the survey of income and program participation conducted by the U.S. Census, 35% of Americans, some 107 million people, are enrolled in at least one welfare program run by the federal government. Many are enrolled in more than one. And that number does not include the two largest welfare programs, the two largest redistribution of wealth programs, Social Security and Medicare. This number on just the nation's principal welfare programs, excluding Social Security and Medicare, has increased 10 million in the past 2 years. Digging deeper. Of those on traditional welfare, the old classic, we'll call it welfare classic, it's 4.1% of Americans, some 13 million people. They receive $132 billion. 2% or 6 million Americans receive unemployment benefits. Another 4% have the government pay for their housing. This program alone has increased 42% between 2006 and 2010. The growth in government dependency is even more alarming than the percentage of people who are depending. But that is just the tip of the iceberg, and that's the point I wanted to make. And maybe it didn't resonate yesterday. That just because 35%, according to the U.S. Census of Americans, some 107 million Americans are enrolled in at least one welfare program run by the federal government, that's the tip of the iceberg. Because 30% of those who file income tax returns receive a new form of welfare, a new form of wealth redistribution that's not counted in that. 30% of those who file tax returns receive the EITC, the new name for wealth redistribution in America, the new name for welfare in America. It's the Earned Income Tax Credit. Of course, called earned and called income and called a tax and called a credit when it's none of those things. It isn't earned, it isn't income, it isn't a tax, it's the antithesis of it, and it isn't a credit. It's a check. 30%. Now, you can't just go and add the 30% of tax filers to the 35% who are enrolled in one of the more traditional welfare programs and get 65%, because many of those, first of all, many Americans don't file income tax returns, so that's not 30% of all Americans that receive the EITC. Beyond that, many Americans are double-dipping. They're benefiting from the EITC and other government welfare programs. So the total is probably around the same percentage. About 50% of Americans are dependent economically. And that's before we get to Social Security and the big M&M, Medicare and Medicaid. 50% of Americans, therefore, before we even get to Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, receive a check they did not work for, that they did not earn from the government. And while the 35% on a form of government welfare, when added to the 30% of tax filers who receive the Earned Income Tax Credit, as I said, appears to encompass 65% of Americans, not every American files tax returns, and many recipients of the EITC are double-dipping. The numbers are very close to 50%, therefore. This known standard welfare, as I shared yesterday, is so out of hand. In the largest states, California, New York, New Jersey, even in Virginia, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and of course in Washington, D.C., the average welfare recipient receives more money from the government than they would if they actually worked 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year, at a $13 an hour job. The government creates an incentive to not only be unproductive, but to be counterproductive. To this, 50% of Americans who are on one form or another of wealth redistribution or government federal welfare, we must add the 61 million Americans who receive Social Security benefits. That is another 20% of the population that are being paid not to work as part of this program alone. The cost of Social Security is $740 billion a year. $740 billion a year. Now, there are so many Americans who are now believe that they're entitled to Social Security because they paid into the Social Security system. I want to tell you a story. Let's suppose you're a painter. You decide one day that you're going to take 15% of your gross income off the top and set it aside for your retirement. You're going to have your customers pay 7.5% of that, though, and you're going to personally pay for 7.5% of it. So you're going to take 7.5% of your gross income right off the top and set it aside for your retirement. You're going to take another 5% and set it aside for health care costs after you stop working. But with your knowledge and with your consent, all of this money, the 7.5% you paid, the 7.5% your customers have had added to their bills, and the 5% that has been set aside for your health care in the future, all of this money is confiscated by your parents. All of it. They spend it all and more on themselves, on failed landscaping projects, on trips abroad, even on a private militia. It's all gone. It's all spent. They took it. So now you get ready to retire. And you know that your parents abused you in this way. They took your money and they squandered it year after year, without exception. And you not only went along with this immoral scam, you opposed anyone willing to expose this nasty secret, the fact that it was a Ponzi scheme. What you do? What do you do in that case, then? You know the truth. Well, most Americans now have chosen to confiscate their children's earnings. They feel entitled. Their parents abused them, so now they are content to abuse their children. Such is the nature of economic pedophilia, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Today, when I expose and condemn this scam, I'm asked, you know, why isn't it fair that I receive this money? I paid into a system. No, you didn't. All of the money that was confiscated from you, that 7.5%, was spent, squandered on the military, on government plans, all wasted. Now, what we're going to do when we come back from the break, we're going to do a little math. We're going to talk about what was actually contributed, even if it were not spent. Let's just say that the government actually had a trust fund. And I'm going to show that most recipients of Social Security receive far more than they ever paid in. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths.
You know what happened?
To Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yada. I had promised that I would go over the math with you. You know, if you think that you're entitled to your Social Security, even though you you didn't pay into a Social Security fund, your parents took the money and squandered it. The fact of the matter is that if you take 7.5% of a person's earning, on average, say, of $40,000 over a 20, 30, or 40-year period, that's actually a fraction of what that same person draws in a Social Security check, particularly over a course of 15 to 20 years. That means that at 7.5%, at $40,000 on average, that you'd have $3,000 set aside. Of course, it wasn't set aside. It was squandered. But had it been set aside, now the average Social Security check is $1,230 a month. In other words, what you paid in a year is squandered in a little over 2 months. And even if you claim that you worked for twice as long as you're going to be paid your retirement, which doesn't often materialize that way, then still it's off by a matter of 400%. In other words, the recipients of Social Security receive on average about 400% more than they paid in. We have Nick on the line. He wants to speak about the issue of illegal immigrants also receiving government subsidies but not contributing to the cost of those subsidies. Hello, Nick. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. So what I wanted to say is that, you were saying all the taxes, income taxes that our Americans are not paying, but you didn't mention that none of the illegal aliens paying the income taxes. So My life evolves around those kind of people, and I'm going to piss off a whole lot of Mexicans now. But those people do not, even if there is one that legal here. They all have brother, cousin, sister, uncle who does work here legally, who's taking advantage of the welfare, who's taking advantage of those tax credits that are they claim the I'm talking about a child credit and mm-hmm. other, but yet they don't pay no income taxes. I mean, there is some taxes, yes, but nothing there. That's one of the things that I just want you to mention and talk about.
All right. No, I'd be glad to. Nick, first of all, let me say that one of the things I always feel uncomfortable about is when people are singled out by race. Race is never a problem. Political policy and religion are problems. Race is not a problem. As it relates to illegal immigrants receiving benefits and paying no taxes, that problem is easily resolved. And all you'd have to do to resolve it is eliminate the federal income tax, replace it with a national sales tax. If we had a national sales tax, everybody would pay their fair share. The more you bought, the more you'd pay. And it would be impossible to get around. So simple solution to that is you want everybody to pay their fair share, impose a national sales tax to support those things that the Constitution has the government being responsible for, eliminate all of the wealth redistribution, and everybody pays their fair share, and the system is flush, and we don't have national debt. Problem easily resolved. The thing that I wanted to make clear, and we have just a couple of minutes before we move on to our conversation with God, is that Yahweh does not want us reliant on government. And yet that is what most Americans have become. We have embraced what he asked us to walk away from. God specifically told Abram, before he could engage in a relationship with him, to walk away from his country. And the reason is that God does not want us, as we have become, dependent upon our country. Because our country is a human institution. They are not reliable. They beguile, they lie, they deceive, they're destructive, they lead astray. And God says, rather than being reliant on your country, I want you reliant on me. And so is there the possibility that you can receive government handouts and still be set apart from your country? Sure. But when, along the way, are you so enthralled with what the government is giving you? You feel so entitled to what the government is giving you. You're so dependent upon what the government is giving you that you're not only a recipient of these funds, but an advocate for them. That you support what the government is doing. When you advocate economic pedophilia, when is it that you've gone so far down the line that you're incapable of being reliant on Yahweh because you've chosen instead to be reliant on a political institution which he asked you to walk away from? It's a question that we all must ask of ourselves and of our country. And the answer for most is they prefer their government to God.
A little over a year ago, I began to do a lot of research into why, even though I had a pretty good